Welcome to Took Talk, a video podcast by the band Took, and brought to you by Black Frog Media. We chat with the best in the music industry from yesterday and today, with a focus on the good old days of Canadian rock. This episode originally streamed live on Tuesday, March 2nd, 2021 on Facebook Live. Now, here are your hosts, Todd, Brent, Shane, Corey, and Darren.
Hey,
back, hey, gentlemen. Guys.
Back to five.
I want to do the dramatic soap opera take of like, what?
Don't do it, Steve. Remember Oscar Goldman used to do that, right?
Yeah.
Don't exactly. Do it, Steve.
Oh, that's right.
It's always the kind of like, I've got some terrible news.
It's a bit Clark Kent, Todd. I like it.
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. I bought new glasses, and they're like actually made by Iron Man. I don't think that Tony Stark from the comic books, but I think it's meant for dudes who are huge, because they're actually like large on me. Look how big they are.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, usually like I get glasses and they're like, looks like
so
I got them.
You walked in to the optometrist and he said, I need glasses for a dude that's huge.
Yeah, exactly. I say that in every store I walk into.
and he's probably like, once you put the glasses on, you'll see for yourself. It's not that huge.
It's not, yeah, exactly. You clearly need glasses, is what he says.
Yeah. How you guys been?
Good, man. Good. Shane's here.
Yeah.
Mr. Shane.
Dude, it has been such a drag carrying this fucking thing without you.
You guys just been carrying it up?
Yeah, it's been fun. We've had quite a few cool people, so yeah. But it's going to be even more fun today now that you're here.
Oh, it is.
Yeah. I say it, when you're not here, you're just like the total, like, you know, yeah, I just start whipping boy. You're like, whatever, he's not here. Like, but as soon as you're here, it's like, oh, Shane's here, my best friend. And then as soon as he's gone, what a jackass. Screw that guy.
It's good to be back.
It is, yes.
It's good to have you. Yeah, it is. It's awesome, and I'm sure we can all agree today is going to be great, because we've got a legendary guest on today, so yes. We shouldn't waste any time, because we want to use the pretty much all the time we have, because I'm sure there's so many stories. So
people should know that we recorded a song he wrote a little while ago. The most attention we get now is because of his song. Doesn't he get enough attention from that song? I mean, now we recorded a version of it, of When I'm With You by his old band Sheriff, and everybody just fell in love with it. And every story that everybody's had a story about, like, I love that song, and I at my prom and at my high school dance, we got married to that song. I'm like, oh, wow, okay, cool. You know, I didn't realize it. I'm like, well, that's awesome. I'm glad to hear that. So, you know,
yeah, I'm pretty sure this guy is responsible for probably 80% of the wedding dances in, you know, in Canada or all over the world. So, well, I'm sure we'll get to all those, but yeah. We should bring him on and you know, get his take on it. So, Corey, I'll give you with the introduction today.
Sure. So, our guest today, I'm so excited about, from one of my favorite Canadian bands, two of my favorite Canadian bands, Frozen Ghost and Sheriff. Right. He's played with three of our past Took Talk people.
That's right.
Freddie Kirchy.
That's right.
Phil X.
That's right.
And Derry Grahan.
I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either until today.
From Honeymoon Suite.
Exactly.
Yep. Okay.
He wrote When I'm With You, like you just said, our current single.
Mm-hmm.
And was a member of Sheriff, went on after Sheriff broke up to front Frozen Ghost with the bass player from Sheriff, Wolf Hassel. Then after that broke up in the 90s, then he went on to produce, become a huge big-time producer. Our Lady Peace, Finger 11, King's X, Simple Plan, Thousand Foot Crutch. And he's a Juno Award winner. It's going to be an awesome show today. Please welcome to the show, Arnold Lanny.
Hey, Arnold.
Hi, Arnold.
Hello.
That's great. I would pay admission just to hear you guys banter. Just what you guys are doing your thing.
It gets old really quick.
It's too bad you had to bring me on. It's like now your show's just going to go down
Not at all. Trust me. It's kind of like when you when the Beatles brought in Billy Preston because they didn't get along anymore. That's what's happening here. That's what's happening.
Good one, Todd. So it's so cool to have you on the show. You're in LA, aren't you? Right. You live here now, do you?
Yep. I live just out. I couldn't see myself living in Los Angeles. When we moved here about 15 years ago or so, I had, I still have four children, but they're grown up now, but they were younger, and we just didn't want to live inside of Los Angeles. I wanted access to it. Mm-hmm. And a lot of the artists that I work with, as long as I was near an airport, so we decided to go to a place called Temecula, which, when you first hear it, sounds like you're suffering from incurable disease. You know, it's like, I have Temecula. It's like, oh, yeah. But in fact, it's just a beautiful little town, just a lot of vineyards and orchards. And you know, we drove here and thought, we went up and down Highway 5, starting in Calabasas, went all the way to San Diego, came back up the other side, found this place and said, this is where we're going to live. And so we've been here ever since. So it's about 75 miles southeast of Los Angeles. The climate is it's considered a desert climate. And so, you know, we don't get any rain. Like, I mean, we get less rain than Los Angeles. So it's crazy. So
that's okay. Hey,
thank you for having me on, though, guys.
No problem.
And I got to tell you, I was so honored and flattered that you guys wanted to record that song. And when I heard, it's funny because I guess after it was done, because I didn't know you were doing it until my phone started to blow up. And hey, you know, check this out. I got a bunch of links sent to me. And I said, fuck, these guys sound awesome. Who are they? You know, so you did a great, great job. You know, and for me, that song has, I mean, songs are sort of like children. You know, it's like they all have their own personality. They sometimes don't reach success you want them to have, you know, but you love them nonetheless. You know what I mean? But that song was really never intended to be a song that I wanted to record myself, let alone to have other people record. I literally wrote that for my girlfriend, who's now my, you know, been my wife for like since the Mesozoic era. And so basically,
since the Temecula era.
It was literally about 40 years ago. And, you know, being a broke musician, it was Valentine's Day. I didn't have any money, but like, so that's a shocker, right? A young musician with no money. Never heard of that before. But, you know, I wanted to do something nice for her, but I couldn't afford to get her something special, let's say, like at a store. So I thought, well, I'll just write her a song and then I'll sing it into a set recorder. So I literally went downstairs, living at my mom's place at this point. Again, shocker, musician. I just, you know, put my coffee down and song came out and I said, okay, well, what should I say? Well, I guess I'm going to talk about how I feel when she's around. And that doesn't sound right. So I thought, yeah, when I'm with you, I feel this and I feel that. And I said, all right, let's do that. And honestly, God, maybe 5-10 minutes later, I sang it into the recorder. And my plan was to play it for that. We used to go to donut shops. Like, that was the highlight of our dating life. You know, like, in those days, they had these games called Pac-Man and stuff. Like, these, like, you go to a donut shop, you... you steal like 11 quarters out of your mother's coat, and you basically, I'd say at a donut shop, we'd share a French cruller and a couple of coffees. Being Canadian, you know, like,
but it went
country style or Tim Hortons, right? Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, my plan was, I was going to see her that night, and I'll pick her up, but before we go into the donut shop, I'll play it. I'll put it in the Vance player, which for those people who are way too young don't know what that is. It's an old tape device. I actually met people that don't know what a cassette player is.
Like, yeah, I know. Yeah.
It's like, fuck, am I old? Jesus. but at any rate, I put it in and I said, I wanted to give you this for Valentine's. Of course, you know, my recollection is, you know, of course, starts crying, and that was awesome. Because you know what's coming next, you know? It's like, she's happy, right? It's like,
good thing you have the van, right? Yeah.
Right? I mean, there's always a motivation. We're guys, right?
But yeah.
At any rate, you know, she had, I played for her, she loved it, and I thought of it again until we're getting, I'd say about a year or so went by.
Really?
We're in a studio, and yeah, and then the producer at the time did the first Sheriff record. We were literally packing up our stuff, getting ready to go to Hamilton. We recorded at a place called Grand Avenue, which was owned by Danny Renoir, who was literally producing U2 at the time. We were at his studio, but we were, before that, we were rehearsing in an 8-track studio. Again, it's hard to imagine today that there would even be a studio that had an 8-track when you could literally have a laptop in your house today with 512 tracks, you know?
Yeah.
But it is what it is. So at any rate, we're really packing up, and the producer says, so there's no other material, right? And I said, being leader of the band, I said, no, that's pretty well it. He said, okay. And then one of the guys in the band said, what about that song your girlfriend always talks about? Like, how, you know, like, what's that? No, that's a real song. I said, no, well, so now the producer, of course, and of course me, that's what I've been doing the last 30 years is production. It's like, well, let me hear it. You know, it's like, because we often attach feelings to songs that, and that's what gets songwriters, also artists, in trouble sometimes, because they attach a feeling to it that only they are experiencing, good or bad.
Right.
The idea is so that make sure that the listener experiences the same feeling you are. But at any rate, I said, no, that's all of it. And he said, well, what song are they talking about? I said, it's nothing. It's a nice song. It's just a song I wrote for my girlfriend. Well, then let me play it. And of course, my Rhodes is all packed up at this point. A giant Hammond C3. Like, I mean, in those days stuff, you just put it under your arms. Like, this is like big shit.
Yeah.
So he literally said, no, I'm not leaving until you play it. So I said, all right, but you have to promise me we're not going to record it. So I ended up playing it for him, and he says, oh, no, we're recording that. And I fought him, which is, and I'll tie this into something else later. And I said, no, but sure enough, we go to the studio, we're starting to track. And then he says, okay, now we're going to record that girlfriend song you have. And I said, no, that's it's like, no, you record that. But so finally I relented, because at this point, the production company had heard it and said, no, we have to record that. And I said, okay, I'm only going to record it if you promise it's not going to be a single. If you don't release it, it's just going to stay on the album. In those days, you could do that, because you'd earmark certain songs as being singles, and the rest were AOR tracks or album-oriented tracks that just your fans got to hear. And of course, they said, oh, yeah, sure. And me, like an idiot, believed them. So we recorded the song, and the whole rep, I mean, it didn't take longer than a few weeks. We did the basics in maybe 2 or 3 weeks, and then went into these local joints and would do a background here, some guitar overdubs here, and so on and so forth. But I mean, the song, the way I remember it is, we went in, played it once through, the guy hits the talk back and says, hey, how's that? bass player said, okay, I missed something in the fourth bar. Okay, I missed harmony here, blah, blah, blah. Okay, we'll do a second pass. And we punched on the fly. Within about three takes, like the major part of the song was done. So jump ahead now, and the album gets released. And it's doing okay, but right in the middle of it, as and this isn't the only time it's happened to a lot of musicians, we were signed to Los Angeles, which for Canadian band was a big deal. So EMI in LA just got rid of the guy who signed us. So in now comes the new president. And of course, now it's lose-lose, because it keeps us and we're successful. The shareholders go, why did we fire the guy that signed these guys? Right? Mm-hmm. He keeps us and we stiff. He says, that's why we hired you, to get rid of the idiots that this guy signed. So within a matter of weeks of him, right? So we knew we were going to get dropped. So at any rate, the song comes out literally as we're getting dropped. So on one hand, there's like a whole dinner album, which in those days meant it was discontinued. Okay. Like it's, if you ever see an album with a hole in the corner in those big 12 inches, it means that they're out of, and you're not supposed to pay full pot for them.
Wow.
So at any rate, but this song, When I'm With You, again, it was released twice. So the first time it was released, when I'm talking about, I want to say 1982, 1983, around there. No, about 82, around there. Early 82, I want to say. Anyway, everywhere they played it, it went to number one. The problem, though, the record company wasn't pushing it. So it was number one in Detroit, but in Chicago, they'd never heard of it. Like, it's a three-hour drive, but then in Pittsburgh, it was number one. But in Cleveland, they hadn't heard of it. So the song went to number one in so many major markets, but basically with no support. It fizzled out. It died. Band split up. So 7 years go by now, right? Out of principle, I go back during this time, band splits up, I start Frozen Ghost. I remember signing away the publishing to the song, and I always felt bad about it because I thought, this is dumb. Like, why do they deserve it? Like, I don't understand. I can even understand sharing it, but, like, long story short, we approached the production company, and they had fallen on hard times. So we bought publishing back.
Oh, cool.
2 years go by. Yeah. Now, when I bought that publishing back, everybody on my team said I was an idiot.
Really?
Because the album's deleted, right? This is during the video era, so there was no video to it. Like, MTV was huge. It's like, it's one of those old hair bands. No one gives a shit, right? But I said, I give a shit. I wrote that for my what? It's like, I'll be fucking damned if I don't care if it never makes a penny. I'm going to own it. Mm-hmm. So, and you know, everybody, my accountant, my lawyer all said, you shouldn't do this. You shouldn't. But I took the advance I made from Frozen Ghost and went to buy that. Because I made Frozen Ghost in my house. So I was able to save some money there. But I did it. This is before me and all that stuff. But anyway, that's the story. But 2 years go by, and I'm sitting, and you guys will appreciate this because being Canadian, I'm sitting in Kenora, Ontario. Okay? It's the middle of, I want to say January. Probably January, the end of January. And in those days, because we didn't have a cell phone, we had to stop at every city, get on a phone booth, and phone our manager, who was my brother at the time, to find out what times are load in, blah, 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 to get all our sort of, you know what it's like when you're on the road, right?
Yeah.
Like, what hotel are we in? All this kind of stuff. I don't
know how we did it, thinking back now.
Yeah.
It was insane.
Like, yeah.
I mean, and then so anyways, I went up. I said to Kev, our driver, I said, Kev, at the next like pull over in Kenora, I got to phone the office before it gets late. So I called the office, and all I hear is screaming in the back. And I'm going, what's going on? My brother is like, you're not going to fucking believe this. We have a hit. And I'm thinking, how's that possible? Because Frozen Ghost, we had just put a song 2 months earlier, and we were chasing that up and down. And it's like, I haven't heard anything. No, it's the other song. What? It's like, yeah, right. When I'm with you, what are you talking about? Well, long story short, and I might get some of the cities wrong, but I want to say it was Reno, Nevada. Back in those days, in the early 80s, radio was having a tough time with MTV because MTV wanted the world to know they brought us. And of course, with the radio industry and the history they had, you know, of breaking the Beatles and Elvis and Little Richard, all these, they said, no, we still have power.
Right.
So one day, this is a story I was told by the people who were responsible for it, both the guy from Capitol and the guy at Reno. I want to say it was Reno. It might have been Las Vegas, but it was one of those towns.
Mm-hmm.
The PD director, the program director, is talking now to the guy at Capitol and having some, you know, chit chat, small talk. It's after work. What's going on? So, yeah, market this and that. It's like, fuck, man. Like, we need something different. And he says, you know what? I'm going to send you something. And Brian Reno says, well, what do you go? Just let me send you something. Okay. He goes, but do me a favor. When you get it, play it. And then wait. He says, yeah. But, and a few days go by. He gets this 45. Right? Plays it off a 45. In those days, you didn't do it. Played it off a cartridge, right?
Yeah, yeah.
All of a sudden, the phones go crazy. Now, again, in those days, you'd have what they call live action. It was, if the phone was a turntable hit, it meant that nobody gave a shit. Like, it climbed the chart, but nobody cared. When a song was live, it meant the phones were going crazy. Because kids would call up and say, hey, play that sound that goes, Bada! And that's judged. I'm not kidding. That's how they did it. So they played it. The phones all lit up. And they call and go, yeah, play the, you know, the song. And they'd sing the song. And he thought, this is insane. So he said, next hour, he says, we're going to play. He tells this team, we're going to play it again, guys. Plays it again. Phones light up. Plays it the next hour again. Phones light up. The next day, he calls the guy at Capitol and says, okay, how did you do that? Like, he goes, don't tell me. You played the song and the phones lit up. He goes, yeah, how the fuck did you do that? He goes, no. He goes, years ago, that song, he goes, I was the program director in Detroit. And we used to have the top six at six. And that song, I couldn't beat it with a stick. He said, we lived with a lie just to get it off the fucking radio because people kept requesting it every day. Just to get rid of it because we had to say, oh, we have a winner. You know, it's like, lo and behold, it's, you know, Johnny and the Johnsons, you know, it's yeah, like, yeah. Just to get us off the radio. So he says, I'm telling you, he says, well, where's Ben now? He goes, oh, no, they're gone. Like, he says, so the whole band? He goes, nope. Is there a video? Nope. He said, ah, that's perfect. So he literally sends this song up to all the sister stations. And, you know, every station is owned by a conglomerate, right? In those days, it wasn't quite what it is now, but you might have a company that owned, you know, 20 stations, another one that owned 40 stations. So this company happened to own quite a few stations, you know, like Tulsa, Seattle. And anyway, they sent this song, they made a card, and they sent it out with instructions, play this song. Mm-hmm. So as they got it, no bio, nothing. Play it, all the phones lit up. They're having their meetings. It's like, okay, before the conversations could start, they'd say, what's going on with the song? Who are these guys? Why are my phones so active? How is this happening? Let's just run with it. And so he calls the guy from Capitol, says, hey, we're going to play this. No, no. He goes, no, you can't. We don't even own the band. He says, you can't do that. It's deleted. But they're gone. It's like, it's too late. Like, it's already getting requests. By the time I got word, it was already top 40 on the Hot 100 Billboard charts in America. So at this point now, everybody's trying to play catch up. Like, they're trying to figure out, okay, find these guys, put back together, put them on the road. And I'm saying, no, I'm not going to do that. Like, I'm flattered that the song. Anyway, as you know, with Billboard, the writers and the band always know a week ahead of time. So on that phone call, I had heard, next week, you're going to be in the top 40 on the Hot 100 with a bullet.
Wow.
And I said, that's impossible. And my brother said, no, we just got off the phone. So, and then the week after that, we're like, you know, 31 with a bullet. And of course, for people that don't know what the bullet meant, it was our, the trajectory was going up.
Yeah.
And so and I remember like it was yesterday. I think we kicked Paula Abdul out of first position. The week ahead, I got the call, and we were in, you know, I don't know, bumfuck Wisconsin or someplace. I don't know. But anyway, we got the call and said, Rob says, congratulations. He says, next week, your song is going to be number one song in the world.
Wow.
No video. Great. Think of it. No video, nothing to recoup.
No, no.
How crazy that.
Yeah.
Right? No record label.
No.
I mean, it wasn't like we had Spotify today where you can literally, you don't need a label. In those days, eight guys with bad suits controlled your live.
Yeah, yeah.
Your music lives. You know, if they didn't like you, that's the way it was. But anyway, that song went on to have a life. It went to number one again, but this time it went prop across every major market, and of course the fan mail, which was actually literally letters, paper in those days.
Mail,
So that's why that song means a lot to me. It was written in the most purest, honest fashion, because I never intended it for it to be a song. Never, you know, I mean,
no.
But it also taught me when I went on to do production that there's a lot of bands that, you know, they'll have a song and go, yeah, you don't really want to record that. It's like, well, yeah, but it's a good song. We're gonna record this. And I gotta fight them. You would not believe some of the discussions I've had, fellas, songs that have been number one songs around the world. That I literally had to, like, promise them, okay, I'll buy you dinner for a month. just trust me on this. You know what I mean? You know, it was the best thing they ever did. But that song, and I've got a handful of others that really mean a lot. But the way you guys did it, that's what made it special. Is it brought back every feeling that I had when I wrote it. So that's the mark to me of a good performance, is when you feel that. When I can hear it 40 years later and go, fuck, what a great job.
Like, wow, that's awesome.
Really did a great job.
That means that's a lot.
Really great job.
That's awesome to hear from you.
We just used your blueprint. That's all we did. And, you know, it's a testament to the song for sure. I'm curious to know, do you still have that cassette demo?
Yeah.
Thank you, wife.
You know what's weird? My wife, because it was Valentine's just the other day, and I, like an idiot, forgot.
But remember, I wrote your song, honey. I did.
Romantic. You know what, guys? And that can only get you maybe to the 35th year. After that, but no, like my wife's awesome. You know, like we just started talking about it because when the song number one the second time. I had a cousin who commissioned an artist to make me something to commemorate. It's the only award I keep on the wall. Like, if you were to come into my studio, I'm not one of those guys that, you know, hangs up awards and shit. Like, I remember being a kid going into the big studios, and I'd see, like, you know, platinum Bruce Springsteen or, you know, the Zeppelin records, and I'm thinking, wow. I'm so shit compared to that, right? I thought to myself, if I'm ever successful to any degree, and I'm in the position to maybe help some young kid, I'm never in a facility where I have awards about me. It shouldn't be about me. Mm-hmm. And if it is going to be about me, it should be about how am I going to help you? Mm-hmm. You're like, on this particular record, how can I help you? And so, but that award, which isn't an award, it's a work of art that someone who loved me made it for me. So I took a picture, sent it to my wife, and she asked, do you still have, literally that's what she said, do you still have the original cassette? It's like, oh gosh, that's buried someplace. I know I've got it someplace, but
that's wow. Cool.
Like, that's that 40 years worth of music. Yeah, it's someplace. But again, what makes the song, again, I'm 6'5", and so I've got four unbelievable kids that I love more than life itself. That all started, my four amazing kids, which I call the best co-production I ever did.
the greatest hits.
You know, is basically all came about because I was lucky enough to see this girl at some party, and I never used to go to parties because I don't drink or anything like that, but they would beg me to go because I would be the driver. Mm. And so we were at this party, and I saw her, and I said, holy fuck, my God, she's just ridiculously hot. Like, I couldn't stop staring at her. I'm sure if she even... like, she didn't know I was alive, but if she saw me, she probably thought, what a creeper. Like, this guy's creepy. I just couldn't stop staring. Like, to me, was the most beautiful woman I'd ever seen, not just in that town, like ever. Like, in the movies, in life. Like, she was the hottest girl I ever saw in my life. So, I said, well, me like an idiot. Of course, I can't go talk to her. You know, it's like, if you think I'm ugly now, you should have seen me back then. At least I've got a few bucks that can make you maybe change your mind. Back then, like an ugly broke musician. Just look, you know, like what am I offering? You know, really. So, at any rate,
little did she know.
Short, we and it wasn't until another party, we were in the same town, and the guys dragged me out to this. And again, she was there because it was a small town. And it was over the Christmas holiday, so all the schools were let out. So that's why she was at both house parties. And when you're in the band, you get invited to a house party.
Sure.
So I'm sitting in the kitchen, a giant farmhouse, by myself. Everybody's listening to old Steve Miller records, just getting high and, you know, having fun. And I'm sitting like an idiot in the kitchen, literally just sitting there like this. She walks in, I guess, to get a glass of water or something. She looks around. She goes, are you waiting for somebody? I'm thinking, she talking to me? Like, holy fuck. She actually knows. I said, no, I'm just waiting. Like, for what? So she sat down. She started talking to me. So I said, thank you, God. I'm going to take a religion. It's like, this is divine intervention. I don't know how this happened, because I knew she was there, but like, why talk to her? Like, there's no way. But at any rate, we struck up a conversation. Because she was so out of my league, I thought, I'm not going to try to be, you know, clever or funny. Not that I could be anyway, you know. It's like, we just talked. And she'd say, well, what do you do? It's like, well, I'm in a band. Oh, were you at the, yeah, we played at so-and-so. It's like, I guess I said something. That's the impression I must have left you. You don't even know I was in the band, right? but as time went on, she remembered me. And funny thing is, she said afterwards when we got serious, that was the moment she knew there was a connection. So I always tell my son, because they're, you know, really nice kids and they're shy. And it's like, you know, if I would have known then what I know now as a grown man, that a girl just wants you to be yourself and just to be confident and secure with who you are. But I didn't know, you know, I lost my dad early. It was, again, how I learned how to play the piano. But so I didn't have anybody telling me, hey, this is what you got to do. You know, so I didn't know. I saw a beautiful girl and thought, yeah, well, she won't like me, so I'm going to aim a bit lower. But like, so that song was honestly a real attempt to put into words what she meant to me. And
right.
I'm happy to say that we're still married after all this time. And
that's great.
Tried to provide her with, well, like, I mean, it's not like it's always easy. Like, for anybody who's been married, you know, like, it's a great thing, but like anything, you, times that are tough because you're raising children as well. And but, anyway, it is what it is. But Arnold, that's why.
What about your mother?
Enough for recording that song.
What about your mom? Did she get to experience the celebrating it the first time and the second time as a hit?
Oh yeah, my mom is amazing. Like, God bless her. I mean, she passed a couple of years ago, so she saw the worst of my career, like literally eating Kraft dinner and peanut butter sandwiches.
Yeah, because you said off camera earlier that. You said she was discouraging of you being a musician early on, right?
Oh my gosh, she cried and cried when I like I said before we went on. When I told her I was going to quit school to be a musician, I'm not trying to be facetious here. You'd think I would have said, I want to be a murderer and rape women. And she probably would have been less upset if I said, I have to go to jail for 30 years. You know, like, what do you mean a musician? Like, what are you talking about? You can't. Like, this is all in Italian.
Yeah, right.
A bunch of swear words, you know. You know, so I felt bad, but I just, you know, I always tell the kids that I work with, like, if music for me, it wasn't something that I wanted to do. It was kind of like breathing.
Yeah.
Like, you don't really want to breathe. You just know that if you don't breathe, you die.
Yeah. Yeah.
You don't realize how important breathing is until you can't breathe.
Yeah,
and
that's
for
true.
Me, right? And for me, making music, that's what it was like. Well, if I can't make music, I don't know. I don't want to do anything else.
Luckily, Arnold, sorry to interrupt, though. I was reading that you actually wanted to be an athlete at some point. Is that true?
Well, when I was in high school, I was recruited by Cornell University. So I was out like a tentative scholarship, but I was an offensive end. And, you know, I sort of physically faster than all the other kids. So like in grade 11, grade 12 in Canada, I was 6'3½, 220 pounds. Wow. I was just killing it. So, right. You know, and I'd won, you know, athlete of the year, and I won my junior letter my first year, my senior letter my second year, because sports to me was, you know, it was just a way to. I think a lot of it, and through all this time, I was playing the piano because my dad had bought himself a piano in 1965. He bought himself a piano just because he always wanted one. And he was, like I said, just unbelievably poor growing up, as one can imagine in a, you know, World War II, right in the heart of it. So he said, this is a story that my brother and sister have explained since then many times. So he bought himself a piano so that he could play music because he always wanted one as a kid. So I hear him, you know, like I hear him after dinner and he'd be sitting there and he'd be, his favorite song was, you know, he had "You Are My Sunshine, My Only Sun," and he'd play this with two fingers, and you'd think with playing two fingers you'd at least get 50% of the note right. Notes are all wrong, you know, but he's just making a racket, and I'm thinking, all right, that's, and you still love that song by, I want to say Roger Miller, you know, the trailer for
Sailor Rent.
Yeah. Sailor Rent, right.
Roger Miller, yeah.
50%, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Roger Miller, yeah. And
King
he,
of the
so
Road.
He used to try to, that's exactly right.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
He loved that song. Which was funny for an old Italian guy, but that's what he loved, right? So
sure.
He'd play a bunch of Italian tarantellas, but none of the songs sounded like what he was singing. But I just figured, it is what it is. In 1970, he died, and so the piano was just there. So I was 14 at the time. I come home from school, and while my mom would make dinner, I'd go play the piano. And it wasn't, I honestly didn't know that I knew what I was doing until my sister, who came down to call me, say, "Hey, supper's ready." It's like, she said, "Arnold, how are you playing that?" And I'd say, "I don't know, I'm just playing." It's like, "How did you learn that?" I said, "Well, it's easy. Just play the music you hear in your head." And she said, "I don't hear music in my head." I said, "Yeah, everybody hears music in their head." So I remember playing like early Chicago songs, like "Color My World." I remember playing early Elton John and stuff like this. And those are, you know, there weren't many keyboards in rock. It was, you know, like Deep Purple organ player. But at any rate, I was playing pianos, what I loved. And then, of course, when I heard Emerson, Lake and Palmer for the first time, which is a progressive band, I really fell in love with the piano. So I could teach myself more. But it wasn't until my sister said, "No, you're being weird because I don't hear that. You must have that kind of a gift." I'll tell you why I thought that was crazy. In grade six in Canada at the time, to take what they call a musical aptitude test to go to junior high. Because we from elementary school, kindergarten to grade six. Grade six, you went to a different, it's called junior high, I don't know what it's called now. And junior high was grade 7, 8, 9.
Yeah.
And then high school was 10, 11, 12, and 13 in those days.
In Ontario, yeah.
So to get in, so at the end of grade six, they took us to the junior high school that we were going to attend. And they give you a musical aptitude. Well, it's not just musical aptitude. They give you an aptitude test to find out what they're going to, how they're going to screen you. Mm-hmm. So I pulled out in my sheet of paper, I'm going to take music. I'm going to learn this. And so anyway, I got the sheet back and it said, "No, you have no musical aptitude." And so they said, "We're putting you in wood shop."
that sounds like
bigger laugh than you do, because if you saw me handle a hammer up to 10 years ago, you'd go, "Dude, this guy should not be anywhere near a fucking saw." You know what I mean? It's like, so I thought, well, they must know what they're talking about. Maybe when teach myself the piano, I just figured, okay, I sucked, right? But so I never took serious. So sports was my way of socializing. So, and everything I did, unfortunately enough, because I lost a lot of friends this way, including being kicked out of my own band, is that either go like full speed or I'm not doing it.
Right.
I can't tell you how many bands I started and got kicked out of the band. I remember Sheriff was the same way, because I wanted to go faster, higher, better. Let's change our sound. Nope. They were stuck doing this. I said, like, there's more than just like four chords, damn it. Come on. Like, you know what I mean? Like, how many can you shove a sausage down your trousers and go up on stage and go, yay!
Lord, I still do that.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I still do that.
We all do that. Yeah. But the thing is, it's just music should be something. Rock and roll in those days for me. When you were a kid, did you ever go to a circus and see a high wire act?
Sure.
Of course.
Well, what makes a high wire act exciting is that it's like 100, 200 feet in the air, and there's a guy or a girl up there, and she's going to walk by this thing, and it's unbelievable, because that's some great skill, and it's scary as fuck.
Yeah.
But so that's what rock and roll used to be like. And then for a period, it's like they took that high wire act and put it off the ground. Now it's not exciting. It's like,
right.
All right, so if you fall, what, you're going to break an ankle, you're going to break your heel. Like, it got too safe.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So, and that's why ultimately production for me was a lot of fun, because I got to be in everybody else's band and got to push boundaries in other areas, where when you're in one band, unless you're like-minded, which is difficult, because we all know, like in marriages and in families, there's band politics.
Yeah.
And to me, sometimes a benevolent dictatorship works better. It just does, you know, because one could argue that the Beatles, I mean, if you look at that, and for me, they're the, you know,
the architect,
the holy grail of, they are just, they're the greatest, period.
Yeah.
The interesting part of that band is, people thought the third most talented guy, who was George Harrison, he would have been a lead singer, lead guitar, lead songwriter, lead everything in any other band. But in the Beatles, he had Lennon and McCartney. I mean, how crazy is that? It's insane. And that band, all they had to do was literally tolerate each other for another 5 years, not that they haven't made gazillion already.
Right.
But just getting in a plane was too much.
Yeah,
they didn't do it. And I know bands today, they've regretted, because they're men now.
Right.
When they're young, full of egos and piss and vigor, and saying, well, I want to write this and you want to write that. It's like, well, okay, well, so we're all going to write, and what? We're going to have two good songs, and what? The rest are going to be shit? Is that how? Like, shouldn't it just be like boxing? The guy who's left standing, that's who wins.
Right.
Right. And to me, that's how music should be. Like, every idea should be every idea. But after you've considered it, it's like, okay, is it resonating? Does it make you feel anything? If not, let's go on the next one.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. And that's when bands get tricky. So I've been kicked out of my own band because I'm that guy that says, we can do better.
Right.
Yeah, but, you know, there I saw five people back there and they were singing it. Well, your parents don't count. You know, it's just crazy. So for me, that's the beauty of and of course I got into production in a way. That's why when people say, well, how's this whole year with COVID been? And I said, well, it's kind of like my whole life, because I've always done things my own way anyway. I never did bands that got signed. I mean, like obviously King's X was already signed to Atlantic when they called me. Like Jeff Healey was already signed to, like, I've done bands where were signed and they called me, just come in and basically get us through this process. But usually I was the one that basically found the diamond in the rough way before they could hear it. Spent a year of my own time and money developing them, and got them a record deal. And so, and I'm happy to say that with every band that I've developed, even though we've had some rocky times, you know, it's funny. I remember being invited to at a wedding for one of the guys in Simple Plan, and I used to tease him. I used to call him, you know, Blink 183. You know, it's like you have to try to figure out who you are, like,
right?
And so we used to fight about, and they were so young, they quite didn't get that whole thumbprint thing, but they worked their ass off and they're just tremendous kids, right?
Yeah,
I mean, they're men now, but in those days they were just tremendous. They worked their ass off. We went through a rough patch, but it wasn't, they went out into the world, grew up, made a couple of records, and then thought, oh, okay, now I understand this. And so, and it's funny, I'm happy to say that I'm still friends with all those guys. I'm invited to everybody's wedding, and they call me when they have a kid. They understand more now because, like I said earlier, I'm going on 10 or not doing this.
Right.
And so when I bands would approach me and say, we want to make a record, I said, okay, you need to go home and think about this, because I've made people cry. I'm not wanting to, they just do. Like we can't just be another band. It can't just be another song. We need to push whatever you've got. I'm going to get it out of you one way or the other. Yeah. And it's not going to be fun, you know, but after you hold the Stanley Cup, you don't remember how shitty training camp was.
Right.
You just went through 2.5 months of playoffs, beating the shit out of each other every other night. It's like, that's why you play in a broken leg, is to lift this thing, and now you're world champions.
Yeah.
And music, same way. If I'm making a record, if I'm going to dedicate 6, 8, 9 months of my time, because I was never those guys that would do a project every 6 weeks. I'd have work for years, but I'd say, I'll start you when I'm finished this one, and missed a lot of great opportunities because I say I'm too busy with this one. And I always kid with my wife, if I would have done that record and this record, it's like, yeah, but then you wouldn't be who you are. And I say, yeah, right. I guess. So, you know, but
I'm curious.
Like, to me, sorry.
I was going to say, I wanted to take you back to Sheriff, because that's a big geek album for me. And, you know, almost every song on that, I mean, the whole record, you can just listen to from front to back, and every song is great. They're all different. And they're so melodic, and of course, Freddie has got such a melodic voice. Did you have those songs ahead? And you're the principal writer on all that stuff. Did you have all those songs ahead of time, or did you write them? Because obviously, you wrote them for his range and his voice, because they're so, you know, all over the place in the melody. Well, tell us about that.
Well, you're exactly right, and you have a great ear, because if I have any kind of the attraction I have to music is that I like melodies that are dynamic in range. that's why a lot of the bands that I fell in love with, that I ended up producing, even if it is a band like Our Lady of Peace, they have to have a strong falsetto. You know, even if they can't sing it in you know, real voice, they got to be able to hit some crazy note. But Freddie, you know, I want to, on one hand, I want to take credit for writing the song because I did, you know.
Right.
The two songs on that record, I remember the, I can't remember the title.
Crazy Without You. Crazy Without You. You wrote with Steve Markey.
That's right. There was another one too.
And She Kept Me Coming.
Yes, right. That one. Yes, that one. So there were two songs that we did together, and then the other ones I wrote. And the way it would happen is I say, "Guys, I have a song," and it goes like this. And then I teach everybody their parts, and they would, you know, I guess interpret it and give it back to me. But basically, that whole, and of course, Freddie could sing everything I brought to him, because that was a beautiful thing for me. It was like literally getting the keys to a Ferrari. It's like, you're the 300 in this thing. It's like, awesome. It's like, so I can. Here I can take the melody down there, so it was amazing for that. And so, but yeah, there's a lot of this misinformation out there, because I don't do a lot of social media. In fact, you're it.
We appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm finally in the 90s.
Yeah.
But you know, and people, they talk, so I don't want to take anything away from anybody. They were my friends. They worked their ass off, and Freddie sang like a bird. And but those melodies, what you're hearing is, that's right out of my head.
Right.
You know, that, but he sang it. So, you know, but that's just, you know, anybody who writes songs, you know what it's like. It's not just about being close. It's like, you know, if I hear, it's like, yeah, even if we get out of rock and roll, say Beethoven.
Sure.
Like when he goes, da-da-da-da, he comes down and sits to the orchestra, okay, I want to go, ba-da-da. The Beethoven Fifth, and they go da 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 da. Like, no, I want the other interval. Yeah, but that's close.
Yeah,
no, but that's not what I want.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
So who's the asshole?
Like, yeah.
If that's what he hears, and obviously 300 years later, I think Beethoven knew what he was doing. He could have opted for any interval.
Yeah.
Any note would have worked just fine.
Right.
You know, but. That's the one that
was the money
became it, you know, to use our parlance for. And so I was an asshole like that, you know, like, and I don't mind saying it. I was a dick because, you know, it has to be like this.
Right.
That's why I ended up getting kicked out of my own bands.
Yeah. Did other people bring songs?
Like,
did other people bring songs to the project or?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, the producer would pick, you know, like when I work with bands, I'll say, bring me all the ideas you have. I don't want to know who wrote what.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever idea, we're going to put them in the middle of the floor, and I'm going to punch them up. I don't care if the drummer wrote it or the bass player. Everybody bring in your ideas. Mm-hmm. But if they happen to be to one guy, I don't care. It's like,
right.
I just want the idea. And before Sheriff split up, there was a moment where we were trying to keep things together. And that was one of the things that the band would argue about, because I'd written the whole first record, more or less. And they said, well, if we look for a record deal, we all have to write. Hmm. It's like, okay, well, everybody should bring in two songs. We started like that. Hmm. Well, that didn't go well, because a couple of guys couldn't write at all, right?
Right.
And so I said, well, you know what? Let's just, we had another meeting. So let's just bring in whatever songs, bring in as many songs as you want.
Right.
So I, you know, I would, the next time we got together, I'd bring in 8, 9, 10 songs.
Right.
And then there'd I'd bring in a couple, you know, but the songs were so different now because it's like, oh, I didn't know that. It's like, I really don't want to do that style anymore.
Right, right.
You know, it was not unlike, you know, you imagine you have a friend in high school that you see in a hallway, and by the time you get to grade 12, you go for lunch, you order a hamburger, and he's horrified because you thought, oh my God, I thought you were a vegetarian. So, it's like somehow we made that record in 1981, released in 82, but I always tell people the band was brain dead around 84, but we didn't pull the plug till about 85. Right?
Yeah.
So because we had debts to pay off and stuff. We were still, and they were my friends, and we ended off in good terms until the song went to number one again. Without anybody's knowing.
Right.
I didn't do anything to get to go number one. I did was like the song.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But that's when all the lawsuits start.
Of course.
I remember my lawyer telling me, yeah, you're not successful. You have your first copyright lawsuit. It's like, yeah, well, this kind of sucks. It's like, well, it is what it is. It's, you know, it's kind of like having a mortgage. You know, you want to be in this business, get used to it, you know?
Yeah.
So,
it's just, were they lawsuits for the publishing or for actual writer's credit on those songs?
Well, I was fought on everything, which was funny because I just collected royalties for 7 years and nobody batted an eyelash. Why all of a sudden is there an issue? So
it's always that way, though. As soon as something starts to make money, that's when everybody starts coming out of the woodwork. That's the way it works, yeah.
Do you think the fact that you guys were still so young, that had a big part to do with that as well?
No, you know, maybe. I don't know. It's so tough. And I see it replaying itself all the time with the artists I work with.
Of course, yeah.
Most artists, I always tell the kids I work with, it's like, hey, this song, you can leave it the way it is, or we can do this and play something.
Right.
You know, and it takes a lot of balls on their part to go, yeah, you know what? That's a good fucking part. That's a good part. You know, because they're being smart. I always tell people, it didn't hurt Ringo that he didn't write songs.
No.
He's still a legend. He's still a legend. John Bonham's still a legend. You know, it did hurt Stuart Copeland's career that Sting wrote Every Breath You Take.
No, not at all. Yeah.
You know what I mean? It still made you one of the world's most famous drummers, and I love Stuart Copeland's playing. So, but he's different than a guy like Bonham. But for their bands, and I tell young kids, you paid record royalties to compensate you for the session, or you get paid a fee. Like, I can't tell you how many times making records, the kids in the band, something might be over their head because they're just too, you know, it's like a field goal kicker. It's the Super Bowl. It's on the 47. You should be able to make this, but it's kind of far, but you got to kick it. Otherwise we lose. I mean, it's like making a putt at the Masters from 20 feet out. Pro should be able to make that. Me, I don't get anywhere near close to that. But music, that's why people house. I can make that field goal. I can make it from the 60. I can make that 60-foot putt. I'll drain it because there's nothing
laces
in this
out,
business.
Laces out. Yeah.
Laces out. Yeah.
No, it's like there's not. I don't have many gifts. It certainly isn't the way I look. Let's put it that way. You know what I mean? So,
Like, hypothetically speaking, that if you as a band would have had the success the first time around that that song had in the late 80s, do you think Sheriff would have existed longer than they did, or was the writing already on?
Or would that just have pulled it apart quicker?
I think we would have lasted much longer because we actually did keep playing even without a label, because we tried. Right. Just that music had, it's hard to explain, fellas. Now looking back, that era is nostalgic. The songs coming out of that era were awesome.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
But in its time, in 1983, people wanted to hear Tears for Fears, Flock of Seagulls, U2, The Alarm, yeah. You know, mm-hmm. The Cult. Mm-hmm. They don't, you know, still bands doing, you know, what I used to call hair rock. You know what I mean? Like it was, but you want to do what? Have established yourself, Metallica or Bon Jovi, or, you know, like when I talk to Phil, Bon Jovi can literally do whatever he wants and he's going to pick in every does.
Yeah.
But you know what? They still want to hear, you know, like
Living on a Prayer or whatever. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, like, yeah,
name 100 of his.
Yeah, songs, exactly.
All of which were co-written.
Mm.
He's a smart guy. You know what I mean? John's not a dummy.
No.
He knows his gift. He looks amazing, has a great voice. He's not the greatest songwriter, but you know, I put him in a room with somebody like, you know,
Desmond Child.
He's like Desmond Child, Jim Vallance, whatever.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, you've got some great songs.
Mm.
Yeah. And if you don't have something to sing, like Celine, where is Celine Dion in this world without the theme from Titanic?
Yeah.
You know, where's Elvis without like Hound Dog, and like Frank Sinatra without My Way? Like,
yeah.
You need the song is blood of this industry. It is what it is. And I just wish musicians could see the big picture. And what I love about the industry today, guys, is unlike when Sheriff was around, we couldn't own anything. I mean, these idiots with bad suits were calling all shots. They owned our name. They owned our likeness, our merch. If we sold a t-shirt, they made money. Like, we were making anything. Nothing. Wow. Publishing, nothing. At least today, if you've got an idea, I can work with the band this afternoon, and by Friday, it could be reaching the world.
Yeah.
You just believe in that song.
Yeah.
Now, more than ever, the song has to resonate.
It does,
And that's what's so awesome when I'm with you, is that not only did it connect with you, but I still get fan mail. And there's another song I have with when I was with Frozen Ghost. Some of the most incredible fan mail. One brought me to tears, and I want to share it with you. It's a little bit sad, but it's the most incredible story. It was it was a real note. A guy wrote me a letter saying I could find music for a song called Dream Come True, because his mother used to sing it. For his earliest recollections were him playing in the kitchen, and his mother would sing it to the record all day long, and she had just passed away. And they wanted to put 45 and the music in her coffin.
Wow.
Because that was her all-time favorite song. And they played the song at the funeral.
It's
that's the power. That's when you know a song resonates.
Absolutely.
You know what
Absolutely.
I mean?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Like, it meant something. And to me, you know, if I make $10 today, I'll spend it. I'll make another $10 tomorrow.
Yeah.
But what you're not guaranteed is that moment where you move somebody. And the beautiful thing with writing a song or a great performance when you guys play or you're in the studio and you're playing your instrument and people, you know, thousands of miles away are hearing it going, fuck, I love these guys.
Yeah. Like,
I just love what they do.
Yeah.
You can't understand enough. And so, I mean, to answer your question.
Come on, that's a great melody.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, now we're gonna get shut down for licensing on that.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah, right.
Just tell him the guy said it was fine.
Yeah. Arnold's right there. He's right there.
I would love to hear some, not to cut you off, I would love to hear some stories about King's X and how that all transpired. Yeah.
What record did you do again, Arnold, for them?
I did one called
Ear Candy. I love that record.
They wanted to go for something different. And look, I loved King's X, and I'm, you know, pals with Doug today. I would say the most pure voice all of music has got to be Doug. He's just insane. Like,
yeah.
I mean, now by the time I got to them, they had just done a record with him. And they wanted to try something different. They were having a lot of infighting with the management. And I don't want to speak out of school too much because, you know, the way I, in studios, things happen. It's not meant for outside people. It's meant for those of us that are in the war room kind of thing. But right. If it's, I don't mind sharing some amazing stories. Like I remember with, unfortunately, they were a little bit gun shy. So on the record, I wasn't able to do a lot of what I wanted to do because they were so, I'll say nervous about people fucking them over.
Mm.
And by people, I mean their manager, you know,
sure.
Who was also their producer in the beginning.
Right. Sam Taylor.
So, yeah. It's just a very bad. So, I remember Ty coming in saying, you know, I want give me five tracks on the console. And we're working in Glendale, just outside of Los Angeles. And I'll let you change I want to EQ my own sound. And Doug would say, I want this. And Jerry would say this. Well, guys, this is going to make a record. Like there's got to be one chef. Bring all the ingredients in. Let me cook it up. If you don't like the way it tastes, fire my ass. But this is,
right.
I can't make a record like this.
Right.
Mm. So we found some middle ground.
Mm.
But I remember doing vocals. And I've been used to doing vocals that take like weeks. And we were running out of time. Because let's just say they were notorious for working on their own schedules. Let's just say that.
Sure.
and I was one of those guys that was a 10 o'clock call, like there at 9:30. You know, it's like right. I'm looking at my watch at 9:45. If I don't see people in the room, I start getting a little bit nutty. Yeah. You know? Again, I'm on 10 usually. But at any rate, so we're running out of time, and I said to Doug, Doug, we got to get these songs sung. Are you going to be okay? Do I need to book another week in here? God, no, we'll be fine. It's like, you sure? It's like, oh, yeah, we're going to be good. It's like, oh, all right. So put up the first song, and we had one 24-inch tape, and we had a couple of ADAP machines slate. So, you know, I had a couple of assistants, and I said, okay, guys, I have a habit. I record everything when we're starting because even if it's just warming up, because in those days, you know, you don't know if you're going to get it again. And unlike today where I can literally hundreds of bonus tracks on a drive, in those days, after you slave the tape and you leave one track for hi-hat, you got basically 22 tracks on tape, you know, whatever's going down on ADAT. And that was all 16-bit and 12-bit, sounded like two. So we said, I'm putting the vocal on there. So we're basically, everybody said, yeah, good to go. I did a mic check. And I always hate burning out the singers. So I always do my regular checks with one of the assistants. And when Doug goes in there, you know, he sparks up a joint and shuts off the light. And you know, hit talk by, says, Doug, you ready to go? Goes, yeah. And he goes, yeah, I'm going to take down this mic. I said, what do you mean? I'm just going to. So he takes it. He sits down and he's leaning against the back wall in the vocal booth and puts the mic down. I said, are you going to sing sitting down? He goes, yeah, yeah. He goes, you sure? He goes, yeah, I got this. Okay. It's like, so, you know, I'm not thinking I'm going to get anything, but I hit the record button. The song starts. All of a sudden, this like magical tone comes out. Mm-hmm. And I go all the way through to the end. The assistant, do you want me to? No, no, leave it, leave it, leave it. And like, and he's blowing, like he's got, and he doesn't make the line because he's blowing a reefer with the. It's wow. Like, but I said, leave it, right? He sang the entire record in 2 days.
Wow.
The entire album. Like, it was impossible. It's like, how is this possible? Like, I've worked with singers where it takes them 10 days to do one song.
Yeah.
This guy sang the entire album in 2 days. It's wow. It's just like he sings and velvet comes out.
Yeah, so yeah, that's the best word for it, for sure.
Yeah, he's just, and he was a sweetheart. And of course, this was before.
You've just got every young singer hooked on weed now. So,
gateway drug.
For me, this was weird. Fellas, for me, this was weird because I never drank. I never smoked. I didn't. I always thought my vice is ice cream, and I'm trying to cut that out. But it was weird because I thought, how's he going to be able to sing sitting down, first of all? Yeah. How is he going to give me any air? And he's smoking. And then, after every song, I usually call the singer in and said, "No," and I'll record like 4 or 5 passes and so that we have something to listen to. I'll say, just come on in. He turns on the light, opens the vocal booth, and it was like...
Cheech and Chong,
a Queen concert. Yeah. Like, yeah, exactly. Like the smoke,
the light. Maybe he does that just so he can make a big entrance.
Oh! And here comes Doug. He's like, and he comes in. He's like, his eyes are like this. How's that coming? I said, Doug, you are God. Like, and I'm just ripping through the like. They're like, they're all keepers except. Where you're coughing smoke out of your face, and he goes, "Well, that's good." He goes, no, it's amazing. It's like it's unheard of. That's how gifted he was. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The unfortunate part is during that time there was a lot of, like I was going through an awareness. Let's just say he wasn't quite who he is today. Let's put it that way. In those days, it was tough. First of all, he was a black singer playing, I'm using Seinfeld quotes, white rock music. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So he had a lot of people, like radio stations that in the South that wouldn't play him. But
that's so crazy.
I'm telling you, when I got the call to do those guys, like their manager said, okay, I'll send the papers over. It's like, I don't care. Don't send papers. I want to do this record. And I said, well, there's also Gary Harrison's up for the gig. I was like, I'll do it for free. And wow. my brother goes, Arn, that's a bad negotiating tactic. it's like, I don't care. Like, I'm such a fan after hearing, like, Under a Silent Planet. Like, when I heard that record, that was the beginning of what they call grunge music.
Yeah.
And funny thing is, and I don't know if you know this, but the guys, like we were making a record, they'd get calls from like Pearl Jam's, the Nirvanas and the Alice in Chains. All these guys would show up at the studio. They'd call up because they all felt like they were opening up for all these bands, because in the early days, they would go up to Seattle or the Northwest. Bands like Pearl Jam and Soundgarden would say, hey, if we roadie for you, can open up for you? So they would say, sure. So they'd open up for them. And that's what, I mean, you hear Alice in Chains, come on, you can't tell me they didn't get their harmonies from King's X.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Like, just really. Listen to their first record. Just listen to it and go, sure. And Doug and those guys, they were tuning down to a C.
Yeah, like, crazy.
Without the use of a baritone guitar. I mean, it was insane.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just,
yeah.
And Ty would play, how are we going to keep this guitar? And in my head, I'm going, like, you know, he sat down because he had a broken leg at the time. Again, the shit that went on during that record. But he played feather pick. Like, when you hear a song, you think, oh, he's just simming it. But literally, he's barely moving his plectrum, his pick. Mm-hmm. He's just always playing it. I'm thinking, how the hell do you keep that in tune? But
yeah.
they were in what they did. Nobody did it better. And I'm you like those guys, because to me, I don't think they get enough credit.
They don't.
I mean, they're one of the special bands of our time. Just
absolutely
the OG.
They are. Absolutely. Yeah. You're exactly right. I mean, I every time I see them, I don't know how he hadn't turned into an asshole because he doesn't get enough. Like, if I was him and just discovered gold and someone else took, you know, credit for it, I think I'd lose my fucking mind.
But yeah.
He's still the same sweet guy, you know? And he just doesn't get enough credit for it. And the songs, now the songs we did on that record, they were the label. They really wanted to go in a different direction. They said, "Look, we get that they can do this, and the other." The reason why they went with me, they said, is because they wanted to get some other sensibilities. Like, they wanted to get out of the box they were in. They just did three or four recs that more have the same kind of coloring, and he said that we just need something a little different, and made it clear from the beginning. And it was quite confrontational. They didn't want me to sing any parts. Like, don't tell us to play. How do I ask you to play something if I don't show you what I want you to? He goes, well, you're going to have to figure that out. So,
wow.
You know, they were just gun shy. Now, towards the end, when I earned the trust, it was a little bit different, because they realized, hey, man, I'm just here because I love you. I mean, obviously, I ended up getting paid, and, you know, but I would have done that record for nothing. Like, that's
how long I love them. How long was that whole episode, like, from the start to the finish?
That
it was nice. Yeah, 96,
95. Oh, gosh. You know what? That's a good question. It's all, that period of my life is such a blur, because I didn't sleep. I just worked 7 days a week. I just remember, honest to God, I remember flying to Houston for the audition and then flew back, hearing that I got the gig, and then flew right back down to do pre-production. And I just don't remember what year it was.
Released I can't find out. May 96. So you probably in 95 you were working on it then?
Yeah. So I would say, because I remember being in Glendale in August, September, and a bit of October. So I want to say we had that studio locked out anywhere between 8 and 10 weeks in Glendale. I don't think the studio is there anymore. It might be a dentist office now, or like every other studio. I'm not sure. But the interesting part was, at night, it was two studios under one roof. So we'd be making a racket during the day, and at night, they had a room called the back room, a big hip hop studio at the end of the hall. So every once in a while, they'd stay late. I'd be there at 10 in the morning, and they're still working on it. So I remember one day, funny story, I went down, I had to go back there. I said, because I was feeling a rumble in my room. I got to record today, and I'm hearing literally out of my microphones on the drums, I'm hearing the 808 pummeling through the concrete. So I went back. I said, oh, this is going to be bad. Like, they've been there all night. They're going to tell me to fuck myself, you know. I show up, and just two big guys show up before I walk in. It's like, yeah, I'm in the front studio. My name's, Arnold Lanny. Is the producer in at all? Can I talk to him at all? Just sit here. It's like, all right. So, and man, the smell of coming out of that place. Wow, that was insane.
Yeah.
So anyway, the most sweet guy comes out. He's like an older guy, and he says, yes. It's like, and before I could get the words out, he goes, oh my God, it's shit. Could be finished. Sorry. Like, you're hearing the bass, right? And I said, yeah. He goes, oh fuck, man, I'm so sorry. Are you about to start? I said, yeah, but if you're finishing up something, feel free. So he goes, can I just have another 5-10 minutes? I go, yeah, sure. So comes over to my session now. They finished because I can hear now. He comes in and he looks at our mic on all the drums and he says, wow, you guys use mics. I said, yeah, that's why it was a problem with the bass. Because why? Like, what are you guys using? Well, I mean, PC. Everything's DI'd. Like,
yeah
everything's in the box. Everything is DI'd. It's like, if we're doing a vocal, of course, but everything's DI'd. And he said, so you're recording the whole tracks with mics? I said, yeah. I thought it was a trick question, you know? Like, but the sweetest guy, look, like, if you come in again and we're going late, just come and tell me. And I'll tell those guys to let you in. Like, don't, they're just trying to intimidate you. It's like, oh, I'm fine. Like, I said, I come respectfully. He goes, no, man, you're a good dude. And he said, do you mind if I just come in and check you guys out every once in a while? I looked at the band and they said, they're like, yeah. So he would come in because he was as curious about how we made records as I was about how they made records. Because
totally, yeah.
They start at a completely different place than we do. You know, like,
yeah, 100%.
We've already done 2-3 weeks of pre-production. You know, I got the band out there playing live. And they're starting with, like, a kick snare. You know, That's it. It's like, okay, well, hey, it doesn't matter how you get the finish line.
No, that's for sure. There.
Yeah.
100%.
So, but,
amazing.
So, that being said, I mean, you mentioned earlier that and you can answer this or you can choose not to, but you had said that you had kind of missed the opportunity to do some albums along the way because of your other existing schedule. Is there a project or a band that you still to this day would love to work with or would take a shot at a record with?
Yeah. I'll tell you that this is a funny story. It's only funny now because of the way it's ended up. And then, of course, COVID happened. But about 20-something years ago, I got a call from a real young kid named Chad Kroeger. Of course, this is before they did the You Remind Me or whatever it was called, the big song, right? The big record. Mm-hmm. I get a phone call. His road manager, I want to say it was Chief or something. He called me. I want to put you in touch with someone. So I was like, sure. So anyway, we get on the phone and we talk. And his recollection is different than mine. That's what's funny. The reason why we've had a chance to talk about it, long story short, he said, hey, we're going to make a record. And his exact words were, it's going to be fucking great. And you need to be part of this. He goes, I love what you did with, and he started singing parts of the F11 record. And, you know, he asked me about a bridge in that song there. You wrote that fucking bridge, right? And it's like, and he was really forward, and I just loved his energy, right? And I said, yeah. It's like, but, Chuck, when are you starting this? He goes, Monday. And, like, it's Friday. Right? Like, it's literally, they're starting on Monday. It's like, literally? Like, you couldn't give me more than 3 days? Am I your last choice? He goes, no, like, this, because we booked a bunch of tours, and we don't want to say no to the tours. So we got 2 weeks to make this record. Just drop what you're doing, come down, make a record. Like, we'll record it in no time. And I said, man, like, I can't. Like, I was starting the Simple Plan record. So I said, I'm in pre-production right now. I can't just leave one band to go do another. It just, even if they said yes, I would feel bad, right? Like, right, that's right. Who I am. And so he said, fuck, man, like, you know what? I'm going to call you again. And I said, yeah, no. It's like, no, I'm going to call you again. So anyway, he calls me again. And he says, okay, did you think about it? Did you come to your senses? He says, you're going to fucking regret this if you don't. And it's literally like I'm being horrible. But I said, I honest to God, I want to. And I never met him before. He's so frank. He's being so honest and frank, so giving of himself. I said, you know what? I'm sorry, I can't. He goes, well, you're gonna fucking live to regret this. And you know, and we say, we say like ethically, like I just said, look, man, I wish you the best of luck. I really can't thank you enough for calling me and considering me. He goes, well, you know, you're gonna regret this. And then he laughed, and I probably will. Anyway, months and months go by, and of course they explode, right? Like they become the Nickelback everybody knows they are. So this is eating away at me now for like 5 years go by, 10 years go by, 15 years go by. Last year, just before COVID, maybe a year and a half ago, I said, this is fucking ridiculous. I got it. Like, that's the one record that haunts me to this day. Because I got such a good vibe off him. I knew he would have been well because he was so full of energy. Anyway, I got, you know, I called his manager. I said, look, I don't want to be that guy and just call him. Can you ask him if it's okay if I get a hold of him? I want to reach out to say hi and... So I give him my information, and of course, you know, 2 minutes go by, I get a text from him saying, yeah, man, call me anytime. So we talk on the phone, and I said, and he makes some kind of joke like, oh, now you're gonna call me? It's like, you're 20 years too late. It's like, Chad, I didn't say no because I didn't want to. Anyway, he's such a great guy, but what happened was I said, look, I wouldn't say I'm bored. I just want to do something that's fun. Like I don't want to go make records in 3 days anymore. It's like nobody even wants to make up a guitar cabinet anymore. Like everyone's, I mean, I get like budgets are, like, I get that. But I said, if you want to do anything different, let me know. So he ends up getting a hold of me. I go to visit him. First time I meet him in person. He couldn't have been more gracious. This is about a year ago. We start doing some writing sessions. We got like 3 or 4 songs in the can. And there's talk of, you know, that, yeah, you know what? We're going to put this out as a record. And so, and through the whole thing, he's literally kidding me about what's different now. 20 years, like, why all of a sudden we're good enough? And it was just, it's just funny because I said, Chad, I'm sitting in your like 50,000 square foot house. I don't think it's I think you've done okay. You know,
yeah, like, yeah, yeah.
You don't have to keep throwing this on my face again, right? But, So literally the week they shut down California last, I want to say it was the first or second week of March. The reason why I remember is I was up in Vancouver, up at his place in Abbotsford, and we were just working on tracks. I flew back home with the idea that I'd go back up there. And next thing you know, I stop over in Seattle. There was some kind of issue. Of course, in those days, if you remember, that was the first hot spot, the nursing homes. So right. I came home. I got really sick. I didn't know if I had COVID or not. I just got really sick and like pneumonia, whole deal.
Oh,
they shut down the airports, and we haven't been able to get back since. So the ongoing joke is, that I'm destined never to make a record with you. That's just the way it is. Now I've got this other fucking disease because this year, we were supposed to. We're supposed to put out a record, but of course nobody can tour, you know, it just is what it is. But the only project, and I say no to a lot of people, but to this day, that's the one guy that turned out to be the sweetheart I always thought he was.
That's awesome.
I'm stuffing my ears. Are you getting that well, guys?
Yeah.
Sounds like a little noise there going on.
Aliens. It happens.
Someone's watching TV. That's very strange. Oh, it's gone.
Oh,
it's okay.
Gone now, I think. Well, yeah.
Well, Arnold, your stories are amazing. We appreciate.
This is part one. We're gonna do part two.
For sure.
Part two starting. Wait, part two starting now. And so. Just kidding.
Look, feel free to I know you guys got shit to. Like, it was a pleasure talking with you guys. Like, I got so many fucking stories. Like, and if you haven't noticed, I could talk forever. So,
yeah, I literally,
if you ever, somebody just drop out at the last second, just have it on you and you jump on.
Definitely. Why don't you just be the sixth member of Tuke Talk now? We'll just talk to other people.
I'll trade my hat.
Call Chad up and we'll get this story straightened out here. We'll
we'll get Chad on. In and then we'll let you talk. There you go.
Amazing.
Yeah, on that note, it has been a blast.
Go ahead, guys. You've been you've been really, really gracious. And again, thank you again for doing that cover. You did a great job. To me, again, it's extra special because the song means so much. And you did such a great job. And now that I've met you, even though it is virtually, I just wish you guys all the best. Like, you guys are.
Is it weird that we dedicate that song to your wife as well? Is that?
Hey, 40 years. That was what the younger guys. It's like, yeah, sure.
Actually, next on part two. I want to hear her side of the story now.
Yeah, that'd be great. Yeah. Get her side of the story. That'd be awesome.
You got a couple of weeks to go find that cassette, too.
Yeah, you got a couple of weeks to go find the cassette, yeah.
Amazing.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Arnold. Thank you for your time, man. That was so great.
Thanks
a lot, man.
Awesome.
You guys stay safe, okay?
You too.
Absolutely. You too. Thanks, everybody. Lads. Take care.
Be good to each other.
Take care, man.
All right, guys. Good to meet you, Arnold. Thanks again.
Bye.
Bye-bye.